Welcome to Lung Cancer Update, Oncology Nursing Edition. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. I met with Dr. David Spiegel, and to begin, he presented a 53-year-old woman from his practice.
She's a woman I met about 3 years ago who presented with advanced squamous non-small cell lung cancer. She was pretty sick with dyspnea and a cough. She's a heavy smoker, and so somebody you would just say has bad bronchitis all the time. But she was sick from her cancer, and her imaging, Neil, has been very complicated for us because she's got a large cavitation in her right upper lobe that either has, you know, cancer or infection in it at any one time or both. And so that's always played some challenge in interpreting her response to therapy. So here's what happened in her care. We went through the normal evaluation with imaging, staging, looked at her brain. That was clear. And her disease is primarily in both lungs. She does not have skeletal involvement and actually does not have any other visceral involvement, just bilateral lesions and symptomatic. We do profile patients even with squamous cancers at our center, but there wasn't anything immediately targetable in her profile. And she says to me, David, why can't I just go on nivolumab? It's on the market, approved. Is there a problem with me getting that? And I said, no. And she said, you probably should have left me on that other drug. And I said, I should have, but I couldn't. But we can do nivolumab. And that's what we've done. And we're now almost a year and a half on nivolumab. As I said, I just saw her this past week. She's doing great. Her scans don't look any worse, or, you know, we have times where some nodules go away. In fact, this last week we had scans and some nodules went away. But as it turns out, there's a little rim just inferior to the main cavitary area that's larger. And she and I talked about this, and I said, I don't know if that's slow progression, but you're doing well. Let's watch you further. And when I reflect on this, I think, you know, I think she's basically been on immunotherapy now for 3+ years, doing well. And except for having to come in to see you, you know, I think it's as good a quality of life as you could hope for most people.
So when you see, I guess, as you said, the intriguing thing about these so-called checkpoint inhibitors is that sometimes you see these prolonged periods of benefit. Is it more likely to see that if the tumor actually shrinks, or you're just as likely to have that happen like with her where it, you know, kind of really doesn't change?
Well, I think, you know, the data suggests that the responders have the longest disease control, but there's more people who don't achieve a response. You know, the response rate in the refractory setting is about 20%. There are more people that won't get a response, and they also seem to have prolonged disease control, a little bit more variable. This is the group that most interests me and where I spend a lot of time, I don't want to say educating, but talking to my colleagues about being careful about the decisions you make. You certainly don't want to keep somebody on a therapy that's not helping them, you know, expensive therapy that does have side effects. But if you think they're doing well and there's a chance they're benefiting, I'd rather err on the side of keeping them going rather than spill to docetaxel or ramucirumab or something else. So I think that's the struggle. The worst thing you could do, though, is keep somebody on a failing therapy just to do it because it's easy and you don't want to make a change for whatever reason. That's the mistake. And I've probably gone down that path a few times. I'm trying to learn better about not doing that. But I do think we've got to learn a lot more about how to manage people that don't get these dramatic responses but are seeming to have good disease control.
So I want to go more into this issue of checkpoint inhibitors. But before we do, just a couple other points about this case, and then we'll get back to checkpoint inhibitors. First of all, in terms of her initial therapy for metastatic disease, again, this is squamous cell cancer as opposed to non-squamous. She got carboplatin with paclitaxel. You mentioned the other two common doublets using nab-paclitaxel or gemcitabine. From your point of view, what are the advantages and disadvantages of each? And why, for example, in this case, well, she was on a trial, but what do you normally do outside a trial? Which one of these three do you use?
Yeah, I tell you, I've thought a lot about this and considered, you know, the economics of it and toxicity profiles. My preference these days is nab-paclitaxel, and I'll tell you why. It's a weekly schedule, and that's not good. It's the neuropathy. Gemcitabine is a fine regimen. I've used it for a long time. I find that you can only push that so far before you start getting more thrombocytopenia, you know, and the nuisance of fevers even in patients. Paclitaxel is a great drug. We tend to give that in an every 3-week dosing. Alopecia is sooner with that, but neuropathy is the problem. So neuropathy with paclitaxel compared with nab-paclitaxel will be greater and less reversible. And so I proceed with nab-paclitaxel, and you throw in the fact that the response rate appears to be higher with that combination than with paclitaxel. I know it's more expensive, and I think if you could throw cost out, It's clearly the winner to me, but I get the cost issues and I deal with pathways and the issues we face in the community setting. And so I think paclitaxel and gemcitabine are very reasonable regimens, just not my first choices.
So another issue about nab-paclitaxel is that you don't need to use corticosteroids.
That's right.
And there's a shorter infusion time. From a practical point of view, how important is that from your point of view?
Yeah, that's a real good question. The shorter infusion time doesn't really bother me. You know, I think community oncologists kind of get knocked for, you know, they need that to be true, but that's not true. I mean, I think it doesn't really help you treat more patients or less patients. I think for the patient himself, him or herself, yes, being in a chair in a clinic, less time is more important than sitting in a chair a much longer period. The steroids is really a big issue. I think patients love the steroids in the beginning. They like the feeling they get, and you can give that to them anytime you want. But when you start getting deeper into therapy to have to keep doing that, you start to realize that the steroids have more negative consequences than positive. And so a steroid-less regimen, I think, is preferable if you can get away with it.
You know, it's interesting. It seems like there are a lot of trials trying to combine chemotherapy with immunotherapy. We'll talk about those in a minute. But I guess one of the issues, a lot of them seem to have NAB in it.
Yeah.
Because you don't have to use steroids, which are, you know, immune suppressive.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, it's early, so I hate to say too much about it, but you're exactly right. Certainly the development of drugs like atezolizumab have been in concert with a nab-paclitaxel regimen. Those are the pivotal studies in non-small cell lung cancer. I mean, they're looking at other combinations as well. But, you know, if you look at the early data, the response rates have been quite high, have been north of 50%. I'll tell you, some high responses have been seen with pemetrexed as well and atezolizumab. I don't know that there's something magical about nab-paclitaxel. My understanding is in triple-negative breast cancer, that drug is great there. And when you give it with immunotherapy, it looks to be even better. So I don't know that there's magic with that regimen, but it is one regimen being pursued heavily, at least with atezolizumab.
Now, this patient is having this prolonged benefit from checkpoint inhibition. But unfortunately, as you mentioned, most people actually don't respond to a checkpoint inhibitor and right now would go on to another form of therapy. What are some of the options down the line, both for squamous cell as well as non-squamous, after you get past checkpoint inhibitors? And two that I'm curious about that are fairly new. One is the use of ramucirumab with chemotherapy, and the other is necitumumab, the anti-EGFR antibody. Can you talk about what we know about those agents and any other new approaches, again, after checkpoint inhibitors?
Yeah, it's a great question, and the field's really changing right now. You know, since the fall, we've realized that there'll be about 30% of our patients, 25-30%, are going to be getting immunotherapy up front. And I think for those patients, doublet chemotherapy will continue to be standard for them, whether it's squamous or non-squamous. I think for the more difficult situation, as the one you're pointing out, is they've received platinum doublet chemotherapy, they've received a checkpoint inhibitor. Now you're looking for something else. What is that going to be? Is it going to be docetaxel? Doctors hate doing that. Is it going to be ramucirumab? I think that's the logical kind of next step. That regimen was already approved before drugs like pembrolizumab and nivolumab became more standard. But I'll tell you, as much as that makes sense, I don't think there's a lot of doctors doing it. I've used that regimen once in this situation. I'm not sure why that is. Maybe because you're third line and it's not as appealing to give a patient a combination regimen like that. That regimen is approved for squamous and non-squamous. And remember, it was approved after first-line chemotherapy, not necessarily after immunotherapy. There is necitumumab. You know, Nessie's had some challenges. Its approval, of course, is in squamous lung cancer. It's approved with cisplatin. It's a cisplatin-based regimen, gemcitabine and cisplatin. You know, that's not the friendliest three-drug thing to do to somebody after their third line. And I don't think that's very popular. I don't think a lot of doctors are using that first line. And I don't think there are doctors who are using Nessie by itself. It wasn't approved to be used that way. I use necitumab. We've used it in studies. It's a drug that is, I guess, similar to cetuximab, but perhaps less dermatologic issues. The DVT risk is still there. There's a cardiac issue with arrhythmias that we watch for. I just don't know how much necitumumab-based therapies are actually being used. I don't think it's wrong to consider it for somebody who's never been exposed to it, but technically the label is not really in that setting, certainly not as a single agent. I don't think erlotinib is a choice people are pursuing anymore since its label's been changed. Afatinib is interesting. It's a drug I think some people consider for squamous lung cancer in this refractory setting. My own opinion is that's probably not the most active option for a patient. But admittedly, there's not a lot of great options in terms of active regimens in this line anyway. My guess is most doctors, and what I end up doing, is choose single agent chemotherapy in some friendly schedule, whether that's gemcitabine or weekly docetaxel. But that tends to be, I think, where most doctors go outside of a trial.
So let's go back to checkpoint inhibitors. Obviously, the most exciting story, not just in lung cancer, but I think in oncology in general. First of all, I'm kind of curious, you know, what your vision is and how you explain to patients what a checkpoint inhibitor is.
You know, it's interesting. The conversation has changed to really the 101 class on immunotherapy to, oh, I've heard about that, David. Not only have I seen commercials, but I know President Carter's situation. I know exactly what you're talking about. So it's interesting how much has changed in just a short period. But usually what I tell folks is kind of the simple story of, can we give you a therapy that stimulates your body's own immune system to fight cancer for us? And whether we're successful at that depends on a lot of things that may have to do with just your innate ability to mount an immune response. It might be because of the drugs we use or the combinations we use. But these therapies, now three in lung cancer, are all approved because they've shown improved outcomes. And pointedly, they've allowed patients to live longer compared with patients who've received more standard therapy, namely docetaxel. So usually when you talk with patients, they kind of want it as their only therapy because they've heard about it and they view it as this, I guess, newer and perhaps safer way to treat cancer. And it's anything but chemotherapy. And I think that's its appeal. The one thing that's changed for me in the last few years has been my discussion of safety. I mean, I guess I was guilty of probably not getting too deep into the safety conversation because our experience was so good with most people. You know, 1% of folks were experiencing really serious issues. But now with longer use and follow-up of patients and different agents, you know, the profiles we're seeing deserve a really broader discussion with patients about it's a different safety concern. These are still unusually rare, but when you get them, they can be quite serious, even life-threatening. And we talk about it. Then the question is, well, how would we deal with that, David, if that developed? Well, we'd use steroids or even more serious drugs that can soften your immune response if that were to happen. So very much endorse immunotherapy, the checkpoint inhibitors, the combinations that we're studying, but we certainly do a much better job, or I do, of balancing out the toxicity risks that we see.
Can you talk specifically about the way these agents typically cause toxicity and what are some of the common side effects and problems you see?
Well, for most people, I think it's fair to say you don't really see much in terms of severe toxicity, certainly. But when you think about your immune system kind of going haywire or getting activated, in theory, any organ system can be impacted by that. So when we think about kind of more benign or easier things like the thyroid gland or the skin, it might be a rash you complain of. It might be something we see you didn't notice. It might be something in your lab, like a thyroid test is abnormal and you don't really complain of anything. Those are kind of easier, milder side effects to address. The ones that we get a bit more concerned about are inflammations of major organs. So things like your liver, your lungs, your pancreas. We've seen issues, obviously, in the central nervous system. And so we get deeper into the conversations about the risks of those things and the implications of that. You know, an inflamed liver, an inflamed pancreas, an inflamed lungs, and serious colitis can lead to hospitalization, rarely death, or major surgery and death. And so we don't want to take those things too lightly. The main thing is the risks are quite rare. They tend to build up slowly. And so if you're seeing patients on a regular basis, you tend to be able to mitigate those things. First step being almost always just stop the therapy and then later using things like steroids in high doses. I guess the one thing I'd say about steroid use, or two things, is the use of prophylaxis for PCP. We're not used to that, but that's something you really need to think early about, starting Bactrim double strength one daily, and then stopping steroids too early. This idea of a 4-day run of prednisone or a 6-day run, that's not going to be sufficient. You're often talking weeks of steroids, and sometimes your clinic is becoming kind of like a Coumadin clinic. You're having patients just come in to recheck their LFTs so you can make a decision on whether to lower their steroid dose or not. That's not fun for a patient, but you know, it's the way you have to manage patients to make sure they don't get into serious issues. We've seen the serious side effects, even the more morbid issues that lead to fatality. And even though they're rare, you got to be aware that those things can happen.
Just to clarify, when you're talking about PCP prophylaxis, you mean while they're on the steroids?
Yes, sir. While you're on steroids, I think we never consider that because our steroids are low dose and brief, but these can sometimes be 3 months of steroids or longer. And my infectious disease colleagues, they say if you're on anything more than about 20 milligrams, more than 3 to 4 weeks of prednisone, you need to consider PCP prophylaxis.
You know, people tend to think about more serious complications, the pneumonitis, the colitis, but I've also heard people talk about sort of low grade, but maybe annoying skin problems. What do you see there?
Yeah, that's a great point. In fact, just had a gentleman in last week with this issue. It's an interesting story. I don't want to get too far down the road if you don't want to, but this is a gentleman with a large cell neuroendocrine cancer who went on a combination of nivolumab and ipilimumab. And Neil, he has a CR. I mean, you know how unusual that is.
Neuroendocrine tumor.
Yeah, okay. Basically a small cell.
Right.
You know, basically a small cell cancer. So he has a complete response. And then he comes in with this rash. And we kind of in a boastful way were, you know, you're doing great. We can manage that rash. So we did the typical things with steroids and it did get better. And then it came back. And then I'm fortunate to have a good friend who's a good dermatologist here in Nashville. And, you know, one of these folks that takes 6 months to get an appointment, but we got him in right away. And she immediately jumped on it with creams, very high potency steroid creams, and it went away. And we had held his therapy and he was still in a CR. And then his rash came back and he was now getting bothered by it. This was really concerning to him. And then she recommended, you ready for this, a tanning bed.
Wow.
So he twice a week would go to a tanning bed here in Nashville for 5 minutes at a time, and the rash went away. And I asked about it, and she said, this is something we do for inflammatory conditions. I can't tell you exactly how it works. And so he started coming to my clinic with a nice tan. His rash was gone. And that went like that for many months, like almost 6 months. And then it stopped working, and the rash came back. And remember, he's off therapy. And so we went back to steroids again. And throughout this time, and I think we're now approaching a year, he has no evidence of cancer in his body. His rash is finally under control and he's off steroids and he's not going to the tanning bed. But it was an interesting journey there with that rash. And even though something maybe I wasn't as concerned about, he was very concerned about and, you know, really affecting his quality of life. So rash can be a big deal.
Well, that's awesome. I got to remember that one about the,
the tanning bed. Yeah.
That's a good one. And it kind of also leads to another question, which is you do occasionally see people who have these great responses. And the question is, do you just keep, you know, the treatment going indefinitely or do you stop it? In some cases, people stop because of the toxicity. How do you determine how long to treat?
Yeah, it's easy to kind of follow the studies, right? So your patients are on these trials. We just follow the rules, you know, stay on a year, stay on 2 years. But now that these drugs are on the market and you're treating more patients off study, it's a hard question. We deal with it pretty often. Most patients tend to lean towards staying on therapy. And I am one of those doctors, too, who doesn't like to rock the boat when things are going well.
Another issue that comes up is, I don't know how often you see this, but knowing that the toxicity relates to stimulation of the immune system, the question is, what happens if you have a patient who already has an autoimmune condition, for example, Crohn's disease, multiple sclerosis? What do we know about what happens if you give somebody like that a checkpoint inhibitor? And what do you actually do in your practice? I don't know if you've even faced that situation.
Yeah, we do face it. It depends on the issue, right? So irritable bowel or inflammatory bowel disease can be quite different than somebody with mild RA or a lupus in the distant past. So a few things I'll tell you about this, not to bore you. Number one is the studies all forbade us for, you know, enrolling those patients on studies. So we didn't have any experience from the trials. More recently at ASCO, we've seen data. We saw retrospective data with different checkpoint inhibitors suggesting that the patients with autoimmune conditions were able to safely receive those drugs and did see a heightened toxicity profile related to their autoimmune conditions, but it appeared to be safe. It didn't appear to be that they're, you know, flares leading to death. I think you just have to do it on a case-by-case basis. I manage a woman with lung cancer who's actually on erlotinib, as it turns out, but she's got awful Crohn's. I mean, awful Crohn's. We're constantly dealing with, that was before I met her, while we've been treating her on erlotinib for years now. And, you know, when I think about her, let's pretend she didn't have an EGFR lung cancer and I really wanted to give her a checkpoint inhibitor. I mean, I'd be nervous about it. That makes her miserable. And I probably would look for other ways to treat her before I gave her a checkpoint inhibitor. I had a guy once, though, who had awful squamous lung cancer, very wealthy guy who wanted to buy nivolumab before it was even on the market. And I told him, we have a trial. He said, I have a history of RA. I couldn't get him on the study. We couldn't give him a checkpoint inhibitor. Went on down the road to other standard therapies and ended up dying. I mean, you wonder, a guy like him, would I have taken the chance and just given him an immune inhibitor because RA didn't really bother him, lung cancer did. I probably would have taken that chance. But it wouldn't be an absolute contraindication in my view.
So another really important question and really became an issue in the last year has been the question of where exactly do you integrate these checkpoint inhibitors into the treatment of metastatic disease. We know most people aren't actually going to respond, but those who do maybe can have a long response. And now we've seen some data actually using it up front as first-line therapy in metastatic disease. Prior to that, it was used more the way this patient got as second-line therapy. Where are we today in terms of trying to figure out when to give these drugs? And what about actually testing the tumor or PD-L1 levels to try to help make that decision?
Yeah, well, I mean, everything's changed in just a short amount of time. In the last few months, we finally saw data that showed that chemotherapy, in this case, one of, I think it was four platinum doublets versus pembrolizumab, that chemotherapy is inferior in terms of overall survival. So pembrolizumab in the first line setting, and I think in everyone's view, is the standard of care now, but only in patients with PD-L1 positive tumors, 50% expression by immunohistochemistry or higher. We think that's 25 to 30%. It's funny, that story keeps shifting. Yeah, you know, it was a higher percentage at one point. Some even suggest it's 15%. I think the latest data, it looks like it's 25 to 30% of our patients will meet these criteria. In my view, I think all of those patients should be offered pembrolizumab or a clinical trial. I mean, those patients are candidates for upfront immunotherapy. We have a randomized head-to-head study that shows they do better, they outperform patients that just would get a good doublet chemotherapy. And it's not like chemotherapy is bad, it's just this is better. For the other 70, 75% of patients who don't meet that PD-L1 expression, I think we're in this territory where outside of a clinical trial, it's chemotherapy still. What's interesting are the events of the last couple of weeks where a very small study from a few months ago has led to a strategy of rapid approval of a combination of carboplatin and pemetrexed with pembrolizumab in all comers in terms of PD-L1 expression, that's a regimen that looks positive in an early data set of about 120 patients. And so we may have a new standard in the next year where patients who are PD-L1 positive get pembrolizumab by itself, squamous or non-squamous. Patients who have non-squamous tumors who are PD-L1 anything can get chemotherapy, in this case, carboplatin and pemetrexed with pembrolizumab. And as you know, not to make this like the up-to-the-minute news, but as you know, just recently we heard kind of maybe a negative story about the development of a regimen of nivolumab and ipilimumab not proceeding with immediate filing in first-line lung cancer.
So let's spend the rest of our time talking about targeted therapy because there's just so much going on there. In order to get into targeted therapy, why don't we hear about your 49-year-old lady?
Yeah, this is a very sweet 49-year-old woman, perfectly healthy otherwise, no medical conditions ever, who presented with actually pain in her right upper quadrant. And an evaluation led to initially abdominal imaging, which found lesions in the liver. Ultimately, we found lesions that looked to be a primary lesion in the lung. Brain was clear, but symptomatic, very symptomatic in the right upper quadrant. A core biopsy was performed of the liver and a non-squamous, non-small cell lung cancer was discovered. But more relevant was an L858R EGFR mutation was discovered. And so we proceeded with erlotinib for her. And it's funny, Neil, I was with some of our colleagues, you know well, at another meeting where she sent me a message. The patient sent me a message saying, Dr. Spiegel, you won't believe it. I took the first pill 45 minutes ago and my pain is gone. And I shared that with some of my lung cancer colleagues before we did our session. And they said, oh, that's the placebo effect. And I said, okay. But I got back to Nashville and we followed up and she was completely better. Months of pain that was progressive was gone. And she really asked me if we could look early. And so I did a scan at about 3.5 weeks and she had a CR,
wow,
complete disappearance of cancer. And so it went like that. She was so happy, so thrilled that everything was going so well and life was good again. And I was shocked when about 4 months into it, she reached out to me between clinic appointments and said, David, I think it's back. And I said, well, no way it could be back. We just did scans a month ago, actually, and there's no evidence of cancer. She said, I just feel the pain coming back. So we did scans early, 1 month after her previous scan showed no cancer, and her liver was filled with tumor on this other scan. I couldn't believe it. And she's hurting. This is the kind of pain where we need to do something, you know, yesterday. And so we sent off a blood-based testing for T790, and we can talk a bit about that if you want. But it came back very quickly with the presence of a T790 mutation. And so I switched her immediately to osimertinib, which was approved just not long before this all happened. And the same thing happened, Neil. She said within minutes her pain was better. And she knows this is working. And we didn't agree to do scans in 3 weeks, but she hung in there for me to do them in 8 weeks. And sure enough, she was correct. Her cancer was gone. No evidence of cancer anywhere. We went like this for about, I think, 5 or 6 months, not a very long period. And the same story happened. She started complaining again of right upper quadrant pain. And, you know, of course, I believe her anytime she tells me something because she's right every time. And she was also not acting right. Her husband had told me that she seemed a little loopy at times, not exactly as alert as before. So not only did this time on imaging, we found growth in the cancer in her liver, a return, we found multiple lesions throughout both hemispheres of the brain. So quite disappointing. We can get back into the therapy in a moment, but she ended up receiving whole brain radiation and is currently on chemotherapy with carboplatin pemetrexed, doing great. I know we're only about 3 or 4 months into it right now, but she also got the quick response relief of pain when we started that. So a fascinating story because we've seen a drug work well, designed to work that way, but not work as long as we expected. The development of resistance, we've addressed that with a targeted drug, worked like it's supposed to, but then not as long as it should, and now on to chemotherapy. And so it's very disheartening that these great targets, these great drugs we develop in this case, didn't do enough for her. I included additional molecular testing we did, and she had several other alterations that we regard as very resistant mutations. And you wonder if that's playing some role in why she doesn't hold these responses. But kind of an exciting history and the way we helped her, but then disappointing that it wasn't prolonged.
So I want to sort of pick out a few of the points along the way with this lady from a teaching point of view. First, going back to when she first presented, you said that she had an L858R tumor mutation. First of all, again, how do you conceptualize what's going on? Is this an inherited type thing? Do people ever ask questions about it? And what are the different types of EGFR mutations that you see?
Yeah, it's a real good question because you get caught up in talking about alteration mutations as a provider and you forget that that's a confusing term. So not a heritable alteration. This is something that is acquired. We don't know why. That's the subject of a Nobel Prize, is understanding why these EGFR mutations are acquired in patients who tend to be young non-smokers. There can be many alterations in this receptor complex, but the two most widely described are what are called deletion 19 and exon 21 or L858R mutations. Those are the most prevalent mutations you'll see. And we know that those are what are called sensitizing mutations, which means that if you give a pill, in this case, erlotinib, it can bind that signal. I tell folks, think of a light switch. And when the switch is turned on, a circuit is completed, and that sends a signal to the cancer to grow. And what drugs like erlotinib do is they bind the switch, the light switch, and prevent the tripping of that circuit, disrupting that signal. And as long as it stays in that pocket, what's called ATP binding pocket, you prevent signaling. Now, remember, there's millions of receptors throughout the body, wherever the cancer is. And so maintaining that occupancy or blocking of that signal is the key to these drugs working. And so we can test for this. There are simple tests that can be done often at your own institution or sending out to an outside laboratory. It should take about 5 days these days to get those kind of results back. EGFR testing at our center, a community hospital, takes us about 5 business days to get that result back. If you find that mutation, that means immediate use of a pill, an EGFR tyrosine kinase inhibitor. And these days we have two of them, afatinib and erlotinib. Erlotinib is, it just happens to be what I prefer in a situation like this. And it can work well in most people.
Can you talk a little bit about the difference between afatinib and gefitinib and how you go about deciding between the two?
Yeah, well, you mentioned the third drug, gefitinib. Gefitinib is a drug that's used all over the world, but not in the U.S. anymore. Although it's approved in the U.S., it's just, I don't think it gets used that much. I shouldn't say that I know it's not used. It's just erlotinib's been here a while. Gefitinib kind of was here, left, and came back. Afatinib's maybe the newest drug, and afatinib's story is a bit complicated. It was late to the scene. It's approved to be used at a dose of 40 milligrams a day, and that's the problem is at that dose, you'll see high rates of GI toxicity in the form of diarrhea and mucositis. And folks that use a lot of afatinib will tell you that they don't start at 40. They start at 30 and rarely work up, or they stay at 30 and it works fine. I think because its approval was at 40, that it's hindered its use broadly in the U.S. at least. It's a very good drug, and there's a suggestion it may be a better drug in patients with this deletion 19 mutation. But we don't know that. There's not head-to-head studies versus erlotinib. So both drugs are fine. It's interesting right now that communities and hospitals following pathways are now having to make decisions between whether they give one or the other drug. My guess is most people use erlotinib in the U.S. Afatinib does get used, and it's a very good drug. I don't think there's any data that would say one is better than the other.
So this lady kind of also followed a very similar clinical course in that she responded to the first-line TKI, in this case erlotinib. But then after a period of time, in her case, it wasn't that long, but sometimes it may be 9 months or a year, you see disease progression. How do you think through what's going on at that point, and where does re-biopsy fit in at that point?
Yeah, well, my whole thinking on this has changed. Basically, because we have the ability to give an outstanding second drug, osimertinib, in patients with this acquired T790 resistance mutation, and because we have to show evidence of that mutation to actually get that medication dispensed, the first thought is, do we need to make a change? And then how do I prove a T790 mutation? The part about do we need to make a change depends on how much cancer is growing. Is it a little bit? Are they doing fine symptomatically? I think there's these slow progressors where you don't really have to make a change per se. Or maybe it's a solitary new brain met. You just treat with radiation therapy and keep them on erlotinib. I think that strategy can work well for a lot of people for many, many months. But for most people who progress, they're going to either have symptoms or clear evidence of growth. And making a change is really going to be what most people want to do. And so proving the T790 mutation. So here we are. Basically, we now have three ways to do it. And I hear of a fourth way being developed. So we could either re-biopsy, and there's ways to do that. You can bronch, you can do CT guidance, and that's what we've done forever. There are blood-based tests, and without naming vendors, there's many vendors right now that offer this testing. The idea is simple. You draw 2 vials of blood. In 10 to 14 days, you get your results back. And then there's urine-based testing, something I just have not been a believer in because the other two ways work fine for me. Well, let me give you two quick examples of why the way I practice has changed. So I care for an elderly woman who's been on erlotinib. Erlotinib has stopped working, and she doesn't like it. We've lowered the dose, and it's toxic. So we drew blood testing on her to look for a T790. She's about 87. We drew it, and it didn't come back. Wasn't present. I waited about 2 months and drew it again because we strung her along with low-dose erlotinib on alternate day schedules, and her cancer wasn't growing that fast, but it came back negative again. So then I talked her into a navigational bronchoscopy biopsy. I'm fortunate to work with a colleague who just has convinced me that can be quickly and safely done, and indeed that's what happened. So Neil, we did this biopsy in an 87-year-old woman. It came back positive for T790. She's on osimertinib. I saw her last week. She's a month into it, doing great. So that taught me that you can't just stop with blood-based testing, you have to go after tissue. So then I manage another woman who has progressed in her brain on erlotinib, and she's desperate for something new. She can't do a clinical trial because of the brain issue right now, and she knows about osimertinib. She wants it. So we did two things. We drew a blood-based test on her, came back negative. Then we had biopsied the brain lesion. We had actually excised it because it was symptomatic, and we tested that, Neil, and there was no T790 in it. And so she said, well, is there any other way to get me osimertinib? And I said, no, but there is this urine test we could try to check. So I drew urine on her, and yesterday it came back with T790 in it. And so we're going to start her on osimertinib based on that test. And so now I'm wondering, do I have to draw urine on everybody? Maybe that's the only test I draw. I know one of our colleagues, Heather Wakely, she tells me that she does the three tests in a lot of her patients, and I'm a believer in that strategy.
All I can say is thank you, because I've been like totally baffled why people have not been using urine. It's not just you. It seems like nobody is using it except Heather Wakely, who did the study, and she found people who were negative in the serum, negative on biopsy, positive on urine, responded to this drug. So anyhow, it's always made sense to me, but nobody was really doing it.
Yeah, it's fascinating. Like, why would that be? You know, how could you not have it in the blood or in the tissue that was the site of progression, and then it's in the urine?
Yeah,
is that just
the
final common denominator?
Well, when you get, the way I think about it, urine and serum is like the whole body. So if you have different tumor sites, maybe they're heterogeneous. Some have it, some don't have it, whatever. But the data is there. You see it.
Yeah, it's crazy. And you don't want to get costs involved here. And somebody looks at this and says, oh, that's rare, David. It's expensive. You can't do that in everybody. I don't know. I'm a believer in it right now. One of my colleagues has complained a little bit about the urine test and the quantity of urine.
Right.
Although I didn't have this, you got to give a lot of urine. And collecting it in clinic that day is not easy. But in this case, it was as simple as it could be. And I've heard there's a saliva-based approach being developed.
Saliva. So that's the fourth way. Interesting. One more question about osimertinib. This is a second-generation agent. One of the things that we've heard is that the tolerability is much better than with afatinib and gefitinib in terms of the classic EGFR-type reactions like skin and bowel. Is that what you find in your own practice?
We have a lot of people on osimertinib now. It's been on the market for over a year. Yeah, I would agree with that wholeheartedly. You know very well, though, patients with the sensitizing mutations with any of the three approved EGFR first-line drugs, you can get to that tolerable dose for patients. But you're right, with osimertinib at 80 milligrams, you often don't have to dose reduce. You just keep them on that dose. Rosalitinib, the drug that wasn't developed, similar kind of story. You weren't seeing as much skin issues. It had other problems. But it's nice to see a drug that's effective without that toxicity, as much toxicity.
The other thing I'm curious about is I've heard stories, and actually I think there are data in the literature about the issue of osimertinib and brain and CNS mets. And you mentioned this woman who has brain mets. And my understanding is that you see responses in the brain and actually even with carcinomatous meningitis with osimertinib. Is that your experience?
Yeah, I'm not ready to jump on that bandwagon yet. I've not been convinced of it. And, I still think it's the greatest challenge we face in oncology, if not lung cancer, is dealing with the prevention of carcinomatous disease or CNS disease. There's nothing more frustrating than doing well systemically and then having problems in the brain. It's the big failure that we're all dealing with, that we haven't solved that problem. I hope osimertinib can do better. I hope the ALK inhibitors can help solve a lot of that too in that space, but we haven't come close to solving that.